Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cunniff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Welcome to see him if you're looking for a tractor, a mower, tractor implements, repairs, parts. They do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Got to put the 530 before it. I called somebody without using the area code the other day, and I got Sweden.
Oh, yeah, that's probably not good.
Rut-row.
Yeah.
Yeah, so be careful with that. Our guest this this show is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we thought it was really important to have him on during this because he has spoken with us so many times about the threat of this whole thing. And EMP and all that, and I've got to tell you, he's a prolific writer. He's fun to talk to, too, but he's a prolific writer. There is a tremendous amount of information out there, and if all you do is read all the things we've posted that he's given us to put on all the different shows, every program on our site has articles, links, and all those things about the guest, and it also has the commercial-free archives. They are free to access. You can send them. You can burn them on CDs and sell them at a fundraiser. We don't care. We do this show as basically a service to the public to educate people. So we're not copyrighted. We're not going to come after you or sue you or whatever. We want the information to get out there. So be a blabber.
Yeah, spread the news.
Be a blabber.
One of the things that we posted on the site today was a map of a possible EMP scenario. If Russia were to detonate an EMP over Belgium, it shows the area that would be knocked out. I mean, basically all your electronics would be neutralized. And it's worth a look because it basically is going to take out everything from the United Kingdom all the way to Austria and the Czech Republic, Germany, France—they're all down. So there goes NATO. One shot. So this is really a serious situation here. And we've been talking about economic sanctions and how ineffective they are, and how dangerous they are. I'd like to pick that back up again.
Yeah, they're effective in one dimension.
Yes.
Which is why they're used so often. Because they've become a tool by which Western elites who are frightened of doing anything serious can try to mislead the public and the press into thinking that they're taking serious action.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so disappointing to see it actually working again. You know, that they got their marching orders, the press has got its marching orders from the Biden White House that that economic sanctions are tough measures and they're supposed to be equivalent to the use of military force against Ukraine. Even the bootlicking reporters in the White House press room were aghast initially at that, but they fell in line after questioning the president, doubting that, you know, for a moment. But that's what the economic sanctions are really all about. The elites in Washington and the Western democracies throughout the world have got to know that economic sanctions against Russia, China, North Korea, Iran are a feather. You know, that they have been inconsequential. You know, it's a disinformation, a deception campaign, a CYA exercise, so that they don't have to take risks in actually providing for national security. And they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. So it makes them look tough. It makes it look like they're doing something.
Well, I think at some point, I mean, early on, when you're not talking about a shooting war, economic sanctions do have an impact on an adversary. But when you're this far down the road and you're going to get tough and lay economic sanctions on Russia, I really believe that is just creating a very dangerous scenario for everybody, especially with this guy. He's, I, I question his stability with his this whole move anyway. But now we're going to just keep poking at him and just to see what's going to happen, I think. It's crazy.
Another dimension of economic sanctions that almost never gets discussed is the price that we, the American people, have to pay for these economic sanctions.
I think a
good case can be made that if you look at the net effect of economic sanctions, that we suffer more than anybody from these economic sanctions. And I invite you to do a little experiment and take a look at the dollars, the money in your wallet sometime. And you may notice that that we have these new our money looks is different from younger people may not notice it, but it used to be that there was only two colors in our money. You know, there was green and kind of off white, but now there are colors mixed into the fibers that our dollars are made of, a new kind of money. And why is that? Why did we change the look of our money? Well, we did that because of the economic sanctions against North Korea. People have wondered, gee, I mean, the North Koreans are starving to death. We've deployed all these economic sanctions, supposedly the most severe economic sanctions in the world in history over and over again. So how come North Korea keeps going on and building atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs, bigger and better missiles? Well, that's because North Korea is the world's leading counterfeiter of American money. They got so good at counterfeiting our money that we couldn't tell the difference anymore, and they flooded the world with at least hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars in counterfeit American bills, and that was starting to have some serious economic implications. So we changed the look of our money in an effort to defeat the North Korean counterfeiting efforts. But the federal government, you know, has not come clean with the American people or not explained that as vociferously as it should. But that's just one example of the kind of hidden price that we end up paying for these economic sanctions. You know, the bad guys always find ways around them, and oftentimes those ways, the way they find around it hurts us more than the sanctions hurt them.
Well, and I think we're going to see that with the whole oil crisis. Now that we're importing a lot of our oil from Russia.
Yeah, that's the least of our worries.
Yeah.
That's another thing, you know, they make it sound like, well, the price we're going to pay is a little more at the pump. Let's hope the price we don't pay is a cyber attack.
Yeah.
Blast out the national grid.
Exactly.
I mean, that could really happen. They, after the last confrontation over Ukraine, it was just weeks after that was resolved. That happened in April of 2021. In March 2021, just weeks later, they hacked the Colonial Pipeline as a demonstration of what they could do. And the purpose in hacking the Colonial Pipeline wasn't to cost us more gas at the pump. It did, but the main thing was to demonstrate that they could shut down the oil supply and petroleum supply, provided about half of our gasoline and other petroleum products to our East Coast military bases, you know, which we rely upon to project power to protect NATO or to fight on behalf of Ukraine if we wanted to do that. And let's hope we don't end up doing that. You know, my criticism of sanctions isn't because I want Biden to do more militarily. You know, again, reiterating, you know, my position on this is that we shouldn't have gotten involved in the first place in a confrontational way. But this could have been resolved diplomatically. You know, and the object should have been to use the dispute over Ukraine as an opportunity to hit the reset button in our relations with Russia. You know, we could have done that, and that would have probably done more to protect Ukrainian sovereignty than all of this saber rattling and that we've been doing on our side. These hollow threats that we've been that we've been making. I'm so disappointed in the Republican Party I mean, they're supposed to be the loyal opposition. What an opportunity for them, especially as we're heading toward midterm elections, to draw a line, you know, between the Republicans being a nationalist party to look out for U.S. national interests, our national security interests, versus the Democrats who are globalists, who don't care about U.S. national security interests. They're willing to sacrifice our national interests on behalf of globalism, you know, which includes things like going to the defense of the sovereignty of any country, you know, even if it doesn't have American national security interests involved, so that we're the global policemen. We always pay the price in blood and treasure, even if it doesn't mean our interests are advanced. In fact, they like it better if we don't have an interest that's being advanced and we're working against our own interests, as we are in Ukraine, for example, because I guess because in their minds that makes us morally pure. They really hate the kind of idea of nationalism. And ultimately, you know, what they want is a one-world global order run by supranational institutions like the United Nations, international law, and using the U.S. Underwrites all of it with our blood and treasure as the global policeman, but it doesn't advance our national interests. They would argue that it does, but someone looking at it rationally and taking any of the wars that we've been fighting, you know, in recent decades, it's very hard to make a case how these involvements, for example, in the Middle East, or in what we're doing now in Ukraine, serve American national interests, whether it's national security or economic interests or anything else. But that's what the Republicans should be doing, is pointing this, demanding that President Biden explain what U.S. national security interests, what U.S. interests are at stake here, that you're putting us in danger, you know, that you've brought us possibly to the verge of a nuclear war over Ukraine. Why is that justified? Why are you doing that, sir? You know? And if this thing goes, arguably, it could be, will if this thing goes south for the Russians, or even if it doesn't, you know, they are perfectly capable, the press and the Biden administration, of living in this kind of fantasy world. Let's suppose Ukraine falls tomorrow, you know. They're already trying to make this narrative about, oh, the Russians got bogged down. They're bogged down, all right? So if Ukraine falls tomorrow, I'm sure that there will be the left-wing mainstream media will probably be willing to argue that, oh, look, it took longer for Ukraine to fall than we thought it would. And therefore, Joe Biden made the Russians pay a price in blood and treasure, okay? And so he was successful in Ukraine, and because he was successful in Ukraine, that proves that we don't need the big defense budgets. NATO doesn't need bigger defense budgets. The United States doesn't need bigger defense budgets. We can go along on our merry way, denuclearizing, reducing the size of our nuclear forces, because Biden was right in Ukraine. They'll probably argue that. I mean, that's
terrifying.
Live in that. Try to get us to believe this fantasy, all right, of what has got to be one of the greatest strategic and diplomatic failures in U.S. history. You know, but nobody is being critical of the administration except Tucker Carlson and a handful of others.
Well, and as soon as you do that, you're a puppet of Russia, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And the left hasn't even figured out that the whole Russia thing was a hoax yet. You know, several books written about it, lots of good information out there, but they kind of ramped this up right about the time that some of that information was coming out. And for anybody who hasn't seen the movie Wag the Dog, you're really missing out, because that was kind of like a sneak preview on a little bit of this. We are going to come right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You can find everything about our program, including the commercial-free archive, after this airs, like later this afternoon, at wethepeopleradio.us.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good.
big bad wolf could want.
Listen to me,
Little Red Riding Hood. I don't think
when it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
I figured we needed to lighten the mood. I was going to go for some kind of a Russian bear song, but all I had was Little Red Riding Hood.
Well, that's certainly the left's perspective of nuclear weapons.
Yes, actually, that's true.
Used. And that's why they're so reckless, because they have convinced themselves that Russia and China, they wouldn't use nuclear weapons. In fact, when you read the press reports about the Russian strategic exercises, the nuclear forces exercises, or Putin putting his nuclear forces on higher alert, I guarantee you they'll characterize that as bluster and nuclear saber rattling, okay? Because they don't understand that the Russians don't agree with us that the use of nuclear weapons is the end of the world. They do believe you could fight and win a nuclear war, and they're right about that. But our own elites, are so anti-nuclear and are so incapable of understanding the other side's strategic culture, history, and military doctrine.
Well, they've already said they're not afraid to be
the way we do.
Yeah, they're not afraid to be a first strike. I mean, they've said that we don't. We're all, you know, our belief is we'll never be the first strike country, but Russia will. They got no problem if there's an advantage, but we don't seem to believe that.
Right, and in fact, one of the things I discuss in my article, and this is one of the supreme ironies, because President Biden and his administration are the most anti-nuclear administration we've ever had in history, where he has brought many anti-nuclear activists into his administration. And we also have a Congress. The Democrat Party has never been more anti-nuclear. You know, where we have high-ranking people, you know, including Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, very anti-nuclear, talking about banning U.S. ICBMs unilaterally, getting rid of U.S. strategic bombers. Just this past summer, when Biden met with Putin, Biden insisted they signed a joint statement about stating that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Now, the Russians don't believe that, but they're happy to encourage that attitude in the West because they know it strengthens the anti-nuclear activists, both in and out of government, and further weakens us. And now, under the nuclear posture review, you know, Biden has been very seriously considered a no-first-use pledge. That is to say that the United States will never use nuclear weapons first. And that was considered so seriously that the State Department secretly issued a query, an inquiry, of all of our allies to find out, well, what do you think? If the United States issues a no-first-use pledge, how do you feel about that? And our allies were aghast at the possibility that the U.S. nuclear umbrella would no longer be there to protect them. When you put some of these things together with this use of economic sanctions, the weak feather of economic sanctions to oppose Russian military force, I mean, this guy in 1 year is just destroying American credibility in so many different ways from so many different directions. But it's a supreme irony that the Biden's defense of NATO is entirely based on the nuclear deterrent at this moment. Biden has promised that America is not going to get militarily involved in Ukraine. You know, we're not going to send any troops to fight for Ukraine, and I pray to God he stands by that. and the war fever that the press is building up, and that is the fans of that war fever that are being fanned from the White House, don't end up pushing Biden into doing what he doesn't want to do, put U.S. forces into the fight. I mean, some members of Congress have actually used the phrase, we should jump into Ukraine, all right, and get involved there. All of this reporting about the United States and NATO allies sending thousands of troops into Eastern Europe to protect the NATO border against Russia, you know, when you add up all those troops, it's about 10,000 to 15,000 troops. It's a very thin line. That is not a serious defense. It includes a very few main battle tanks. There's maybe a couple dozen jet fighters that have been forward deployed. It's nothing. It's nothing. Russians could roll right over that if they decided to invade NATO. The whole reason for doing it is that if Americans and the NATO allies get killed, as the Russians invade, it could trigger nuclear first strike by the United States, you know, which has been part of our strategic planning for years, because we can't protect NATO with conventional forces alone, or we may not be able to protect them. Certainly we can't protect them now, when we were much stronger during the Cold War. There were serious doubts about whether we could protect them, and so we've always planned on using tactical nuclear weapons to compensate for the superiority that Russia has on the ground and in the air in terms of conventional forces. So basically, anti-nuclear Joe Biden, who's considering ratcheting down and reducing our nuclear deterrent to dangerously low levels, is relying right now on the nuclear tripwire to defend NATO.
In your article, you had mentioned that we had actually, via I think Great Britain, moved a couple of our strategic bombers into Poland.
Yes.
Never been done before, and don't think Putin doesn't know that. And to me, again, that just looks like another threat that he could act upon.
These people are so irresponsible, you know? They're so irresponsible. They're so convinced that they can play with nuclear fire and that, oh, the Russians won't be too afraid of us. Nobody's going to use nuclear weapons, you know?
Right.
The possibility of a nuclear war happening through miscalculation or accident in a crisis like this is very, very high.
Sure.
I mean, we had a situation like this back in 1983 when we had much smarter people at the helm in Washington, you know, during the NATO theater nuclear exercise called Able Archer 83. And the Russians became convinced that we were getting ready to strike them. And they almost launched a preemptive strike. And the only reason that didn't happen is because the exercise ended before, you know, hours before the time they planned to actually do it. And so the world was spared from a nuclear holocaust in 1983 that would have happened by miscalculation.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly this kind of playing with nuclear fire, you know, it's just like a child playing with a .45 automatic, you know, that's loaded and the hammer is cocked. That's what how I feel, you know, the world is, the condition of our circumstances are right now, you know, because these people that we've got in the White House and in the Pentagon with General Miley, you know, are the least competent people we've ever had before. I mean, these people are really not good at their jobs.
Mm-mm.
No.
As we could see in Afghanistan, as we could see in during the presidential transition when General Miley called the chief of the general staff of China to assure him that the United States was not planning to launch a nuclear surprise attack.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm sure he didn't think that was ever getting out.
And now this. I can't help but wonder, you know, that maybe General Miley, how did we get into this? You know, maybe General Miley I'm just speculating. I don't have any knowledge of this, but I can imagine after the embarrassment of Afghanistan, you know, that maybe Miley has told Biden that they can have a little crisis with Russia and that Miley and the Joint Chiefs are smart enough to contain it so it won't get out of hand and turn into a big war.
Oh, my gosh, that's even scarier than what we're looking at.
I can believe it, you know, that maybe he got the White House. What can we do? We're down in the polls. You know, it looks like we're going to lose the midterms. Everybody's unhappy with our domestic policies. We need something that's going to rally the country behind the president, which is another reason I have such contempt for these Republicans that are rallying behind the president and are not challenging the wisdom of what he's doing in Ukraine. This is their opportunity to actually show they're different than the Democrats and responsible, unlike the irresponsible Democrats that are putting the country, the national existence of the country and the millions of American lives at risk for a nation where we have no vital interests at stake.
And do you think it's just because they don't want to look like, you know, in a time of crisis that they're being disloyal?
I think that all politicians, Republican or Democrat, with very few exceptions, okay, are pretty contemptible people. First, I think that most, having worked on the Hill and worked with now the members of Congress I personally have worked with, were some of the best, most competent people I've ever known. And unfortunately, they would fall with W.E.B. Du Bois, described every system as having the talented 10, that like 10% of the people do 90% of the work, okay?
Sure.
And I think that that's true in Congress as an institution, too. But that talented 10% tends to get blown out because they do controversial things, and they won't go along with stupidity.
Yeah, and guys so, like Adam Schiff stay there forever.
Then they stay there forever, okay? The good guys I'm talking about, I'm going to give a shout-out to Kurt Weldon, who had been the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and the House Homeland Security Committee, the only person ever to hold the position for both of those things. And had he been listened to back in the Clinton and George W. Bush years, we wouldn't have expanded NATO, and we would have been a strategic partner with Russia already. But he eventually got blown out. And Roscoe Bartlett, you know, who is one of the congressmen from Maryland, you know, who had been, if this country ever gets protected from EMP and cyber warfare, he and Kurt Weldon together will be chiefly responsible for that. And I would add Representative Jim Saxton, who anticipated that there was going to be something like 9/11 before it happened, and had and was pushing. All of those guys are no longer in the system, you know, because they have courage, and because they did the right thing when everybody else was wrong. And that's the ultimate crime in Washington, to be right when everybody else was wrong. You know, that's the way of getting your career killed. So most of these politicians, frankly, there's something wrong with them. You know, most of them are not deep thinkers. They don't read. They don't know history. They're not really good at the jobs. They're good with people, okay? But they're not really good at what they're supposed to be doing in terms of national security and the rest. And they have a there's a profound narcissism in these people, where they want everybody to love them, you know. And I think the Republicans just can't resist the opportunity to get good press from the left-wing media at this moment. You know, their press officers are saying, oh, wow, if we get behind Biden, you know, Republicans are usually associated with being a hawkish party, a pro-military party, the pro-war party, and in this case, when a Democrat, you know, seems to be pushing for war and is taking a hawkish position, and there's all this excitement over Ukraine, here's an opportunity to get good press and go on to CNN and MSNBC and get good press from these places that are normally ready to just spit all over Republicans, you know. And they just can't resist that. You know, I think that that's the main part. That's probably a major factor in it. You know, in addition to the fact that people just, you know, a lot of Republicans are just so confused you know, national security, the idea of national security, with being willing to support any war that comes along. You know, any war that comes along, you have to support it because that makes you look strong on national security, which is really simple-minded.
Well, I also noticed that one of the big differences, you know, since we have, what, 535 people in Congress, and we see six on television, or maybe seven, and the same ones over and over and over. And you'll notice with some of these people that, you know, we kind of all love to hate, they live there. They live in Washington. They don't typically live in their district. And that's a big game changer. When you just move back there and you kind of forget about the people at home and everything is about the Washington, D.C., you know, bubble and the overlords there, I think it's just, I don't know, we've talked about that a million times on the show. I just am not sure that you can escape the, you know, the vortex that sucks you in.
So. Yeah, it's what the founders, it's one of the things the founders feared, you know, you know, right in the Federalist, it was one of the main concerns in the Federalist Papers, you know, about that if you established a federal government, that it could become a new Rome, you know, and all the power would be concentrated in this new Rome, and we'd have a new aristocracy over us. And that's basically what we've got. And these people, and it's not just egotism and stuff, I shouldn't understate the ties that, that members of Congress and their staffs have to the military-industrial complex, and you know.
Well, and then we haven't even gotten into the bureaucracy that is the permanent ruling class, and most of the time they're relatively untouchable. I mean, there's not a whole lot. They might get moved from one position to another, but even if they are found to have done bad things, I remember when those Dirty Diana and the other one with the VA, and they walked away with $750,000, and they didn't have to pay it back, and they didn't get fired.
Yeah, they got promoted.
Yeah, and so it's like,
Dr.
Fauci. My God,
Dr. Fauci is the poster child.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Let's not forget the king rat. We'll take a really quick break on that note, and we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know, the last line in your article, Dr. Pry, is in the military contest between Western globalism and Russian and Chinese nationalism, nationalism wins. And that's kind of frightening because there we are.
Yeah, and that's why people like Trump. That's why they liked him, because people want to be proud of their country. They don't want to be part of a blob.
Well, that's exactly right. And
I kind of wonder how those EU folks are doing now, you know?
That's how far away we are from safety, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think one of the hardest things we've got to do to achieve national security, you know, is not just modernize our nuclear forces and protect ourselves from EMP and cyber warfare and deploy space-based missile defense. Those technological solutions are relatively easy compared to reforming the way we think about our national security and foreign and defense policy. Can we re-educate? Will President Trump or whoever becomes the next president, if we have free elections in this country ever again, fair elections ever again, and we get a conservative nationalist president, will he be able to re-educate the Department of Defense and the Defense Department to think in terms of U.S. national interests? Or are we going to be, are we been mired in globalism? And we have been mired in it, in our foreign policy. I in the article, I say in the Pope since 1945, but it really goes back to Woodrow Wilson in 1918, Wilsonian idealism and his 14 points, and the League of Nations and all that. That has dominated, that approach has dominated our foreign and defense policy for many decades. You know, and it's this pie-in-the-sky idealism that thinks that we can evolve beyond the nation state and run the world through world courts and the United Nations and international law, with the United States paying the price for all that.
Right.
The United States
right.
being the global policeman. You see, the globalists don't care if we sacrifice the United States, its blood and treasure, and even its existence. If we can achieve globalism, it'll be worth it. That's one of the things people don't, American people don't understand, because the elites don't tell them that. They'll appeal to our patriotism to go and fight in Ukraine, you know, and not explain that, well, we're fulfilling a globalist ideal here, and it doesn't really, it doesn't, American national interests don't really matter here. There's a higher cause, which is globalism. That they're after, and we have got to change that, because throughout history, until the aftermath of World War One, I mean, real politics is the way the relations between states have always been governed: balance of power, peace through strength, national interests coldly and coolly calculated. What is your national interest, and then acting on that specific, quote-unquote, selfish national interest.
Sure, balance,
you know,
of trade,
not
all that.
Being the world policeman and being there for countries all over the world. And I'm not, and this may sound like an exaggeration to you, I promise you it is not. This Ukrainian situation is setting, suppose we get past this, hopefully we'll get past this, pray God we do, this crisis with Ukraine. Ukraine is not the only Partnership for Peace nation. You know, what happens with Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan? They're all Partnership for Peace nations. You know, in the same status that Ukraine was in, you know, an intermediate step to becoming NATO members. They're all in Central Asia. Are we going to go to the brink now if Russia decides to go after them? And it will go after them, since Putin's goal is to reconstitute the territory of the Tsarist Empire and of the USSR. And so we're going to have to play this game of Russian nuclear roulette again and again and again until it fails, without our own national interests being at stake. You know, I fear so, the way this is going and the way the Republicans have failed, you know, to challenge the administration on this. You know, they should be objecting to this in the strongest possible terms. You know.
Do they get painted as warmongers if they do that?
How can you be painted as a warmonger?
I don't know. It just seems like everything you try to do that's the right thing.
I'm asking the Republicans
comes out upside down.
The United States getting involved in a war for Ukraine.
Well, yeah, no,
say,
it makes no sense.
We should stay out of it. This is not our business.
Yeah.
Even if we couldn't have, and maybe we couldn't have achieved a diplomatic settlement with Russia. It may well be, and you know, Brett Hume, I have a lot of respect for him, you know, said, you know, even if we had promised to keep Ukraine out of NATO, he thinks it's inevitable. And maybe he's right. He may well be right, you know, because that Russia's national interests are reconstituting the Tsarist Empire.
Okay. Yeah.
And so they and they have real vital national interests, unlike us. They have vital national interests in Ukraine, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all these territories. So it may well be that this was inevitable, that Russia's invasion and annexation of Ukraine is inevitable, and that it's going to be inevitable that they're going to invade and annex all these other countries as well. Does that mean that the United States has a vital national interest in stepping in and opposing Russia and possibly getting involved in a nuclear war? No, it doesn't. Because according, if you have a realist point of view, if you look at this from the perspective of realpolitik, those areas are Russia's natural sphere of influence.
Right.
These countries that are around its border and where it has these vital interests. You know, we may have talked in the show in the past about Clemens von Metternich and, you know, the way foreign policy used to be conducted under realpolitik. Clemens von Metternich didn't invent it, but a lot of the ideas, were articulated, formalized. Metternich, in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, he was a brilliant statesman from what used to be, it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. And when Napoleon was defeated, nations of Europe got together. He organized them in what was called the Concert of Europe. They got together and said, how can we avoid another Napoleonic War, which was basically a world war? How can we avoid having that repeat in Europe? And he said, well, you know, the great powers have to respect the interests of the other great powers and recognize that they have spheres of influence, you know, and we're going to stay out of their sphere and recognize that they have, you know, where their national interests are, you know, we're going to let them, even if we don't like those governments and we don't agree with those governments and we don't like what they're doing in their sphere of influence, that's their backyard, and we're going to respect their right to do whatever they want in their own backyard. And they're going to return that reciprocity to us, you know, and they're going to respect our sphere of influence and stay out of our backyard. And this way, maybe everybody can get along and we can avoid another Napoleonic War, all right? And that worked until 1914, when the system broke down and finally failed. And that's one of the reasons Wilsonian idealism and the globalist approach came up, because people blamed nationalism for World War One, and the whole concept of realpolitik. They said realpolitik failed. You know, we've got to go to this new approach to providing for national security and a supranational internationalist order, the League of Nations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Metternich failed after a century. Okay, he did a heck of a lot better than Woodrow Wilson did. You know, we went from World War One to World War Two, and a generation, right? And then we went immediately from World War II to the Cold War, and things have not been on a happy trend for relations between countries. It looks like we're headed for a nuclear World War III, maybe tomorrow, the way things are going, and we can thank globalism for that, because the United States hasn't been following its selfish national interests. And that's going to be the hardest thing for our political elites to wrap their minds around.
Sure.
I think, you know, we have President Trump maybe in the pipeline again, but that approach put America first, you know, that Ronald Reagan, we had a president there that did it, but we really need to change the worldview in Washington. It can't be just one president. You know, the bureaucracy has got to start thinking that way, and I'm not sure we're able to do it.
Yeah, well, if you look at where we are now with Russia and where Russia's position is in the world, it's almost a no win for him at this point. He can take over and win this war, but where does that leave him? And if he's losing this war, where does that leave him? I mean, he's going to strike. He doesn't have really much of a choice. He's put himself kind of in a box, hasn't he?
I know Washington would like us to think of that, you know, because that's how Biden has got a victory. He's put Russia into the box and everything. I think just the opposite is true, really. I think that first of all, if the Russians are defeated in Ukraine, which seems unlikely, but if they are defeated, it's not going to be because of the trickle of arms that
No.
It's not going to be because of the sanctions or the trickle of arms that have been provided by NATO to Ukraine. You know, if Russia is defeated, it's going to be because Ukraine has 1,500 tanks, you know, which is more tanks than Poland, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, and the Benelux countries have combined, okay? And it's going to be because the Ukrainian general staff and their soldiers were trained by Russia, and they know how the Russians fight, and they fight the same way that the Russians fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so NATO shouldn't be, if Russia is defeated in Ukraine, NATO shouldn't be puffing out its chest and pretending that this means that NATO can take on Russia.
But where would that leave
Putin? The Russians can take on themselves, basically.
Right.
But I don't think this is headed toward a Ukrainian victory.
No, I don't either.
I think that the person that's in a box right now is the United States. You know, I think our credibility as a superpower is in the toilet because of what Biden did by staking our credibility on the idea that he could deter Russia from invading Ukraine. And now this weak response that he's got in reaction to that, Russia will be happy. I mean, the casualties, they paid in World War II, you know, they paid 20 to 30 million dead to conquer Ukraine and the Warsaw Pact areas. Much of that is, many of those deaths and casualties happened in Ukraine itself, where the heaviest fighting was happening. They call it the Bloodlands. And they considered, Russians celebrate that victory
right.
in World War II. It's the great patriotic father's war. It looks to me like they're buying Ukraine really on the cheap in terms of casualties. I think Putin will be very happy if he prevails, as I think he will, because this was going to be the toughest nut to crack in terms of reconstituting.
And where do you think if he walks away with a victory in Ukraine, where does that leave Putin? Does he continue his march?
The next step for me, if I was Putin, would probably be Kazakhstan. It's the next biggest chunk of territory, another enormous country. It's got a much smaller population. It has no military because it's so afraid of being reoccupied by Russia. In fact, Putin actually did take over Kazakhstan before he went into Ukraine. They did a police action because allegedly there was an uprising in Kazakhstan, an Islamic uprising, according to the Russians, that they had to put down. And they demonstrated the ability to just walk in and take over Kazakhstan basically in a couple of days. And then they withdrew, supposedly. And I think part of the reason they were doing that was to warn us that, yeah, we're willing to invade another country and that they have the resolve to do it. So I think that Putin will probably go and continue his dream of reconstituting the former USSR, the territories of the former USSR.
Mm-hmm.
I'm most worried about the Baltic states, because they're indefensible to us. According to RAND Corporation, even if we try to use tactical nuclear weapons, we can't defend the Baltic states. And they're part of NATO.
See, that's the problem.
Yeah. And so that will definitely, bring us, to the brink again if he does that. So that's the...
Well, we're going to...
That's where we'll be left.
We're going to, of course, force you to be our hostage again because I don't see any of this going away soon. So we appreciate you sending us articles and things, and I'll continue to post them. Our guest this last couple of hours has been Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and he's on our show enough that he has his own tab at the top of the page. You could just go on there and click and listen to all the different shows that we've done with him. I thought, he should have his own tab. That'd be awesome. So thank you so much for that, and we will chat with everybody next week. We're talking about technocracy with Patrick Wood. You're going to love it. You're listening to We the People. Find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What is it good for?
Nothing. again.